Good afternoon, this is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. I am doing this show. It's about 11 p.m. on Tuesday, August 9th. And on August 11th, that's when my show will play. And that is the last supermoon of the year. It rises August 11th. It is called the Sturgeon Moon. So it's a supermoon, and there's been 4 supermoons in a row, and the last one of 2022 will be the Sturgeon supermoon. So that's one of the great things about summer. We get to see things in the sky because of the better weather and clear skies. I keep trying to see Venus rise in the morning. I just don't have enough patience. I sit there and wait and wait and wait. And there's a lot of buildings around where I live. And there's this mean dog outside. You might hear him on my recording. He just randomly barks like crazy. So, welcome to the show. So, I'm going to talk about astronomical things we can see in the sky. There will be the Perseid meteor shower. And we'll see a supermoon. And the sun hit us with another storm. So, there's a classification system, G1, G2, G3, G4. 1 to 4, it means 4 is the strongest and 1 is the weakest, so it's a minor storm that will hit us. Okay, so there's a bit more complicated how you classify solar storms. So what are the 4 different solar storms? So I thought you'd just say G1, G2, G3, G4, but there's more classifications. So here on Google, solar activity associated with space weather can be divided into 4 main category or 4 main components. Solar flares is 1, 2 is coronal mass ejections, 3 is high-speed solar wind, and 4 is solar energetic particles. Solar flares impact Earth only when they occur on the side of the sun facing Earth. So I am going to look is this question is, what is a C-class solar flare? C-class solar flares are minor solar flares that have little to no effect on Earth. Only C-class solar flares, which are long in duration, might produce a coronal mass ejection, but they are usually slow, weak, and rarely cause a significant geomagnetic disturbance here on Earth. So, I can see how someone will get confused about this, because here is another classification system. Solar flares are classified according to their strength. The smallest ones are A-class, followed by B, C, M, and X, the largest. Solar flares are giant explosions on the sun that send energy, light, and high-speed particles into space. So what does it take to be an X-class solar flare? Flares are giant explosions on the sun that send energy, light, and high-speed particles into space. These flares are associated with solar magnetic storms known as coronal mass ejections, CMEs. The number of solar flares increases approximately every 11 years. So that's where we are at the top of the cycle, at the 11-year cycle. And the sun is currently moving towards another solar maximum, likely in 2013. Oh, this is an old article, but I'll just keep reading it. That means flares will be coming, some small and some big enough to send their radiation all the way to Earth. So that's what's happening now. The maximum will peak on 2024, or we're 2022, kind of close. The biggest flares are known as X-class flares based on a classification system that divides solar flares according to their size. The smallest ones are A-class, near background levels, followed by B, C, M, and X, similar to the Richter scale for earthquakes. Each letter represents a tenfold increase in energy output. Oh, interesting. So an X is 10 times an M and 100 times a C. Within each letter class, there is a further scale from 1 to 9. And then comes the X-class flares. Although X is the last letter, there are flares more than 10 times the power of an X1. So X-class flares can go higher than 9. The most powerful flare measured with modern methods was in 2003, during the last solar maximum, and it was so powerful that it overloaded sensors measuring it. The sensors cut out at X28. The biggest X-class flares are by far the largest explosions in the solar system and are awesome to watch. Loops 10 times the size of Earth leap up off the sun's surface when the sun's magnetic fields cross over each other and reconnect in the biggest events. This reconnection process can produce as much energy as a billion hydrogen bombs. If they're directed at Earth, such flares and associated CME, or coronal mass ejections, can create long-lasting radiation storms that can harm satellites, communication systems, and even ground-based technologies and power grid. X-class flares on December 5th and 6th, 2006, for example, triggered a CME that interfered with GPS signals being sent to ground-based receivers. Okay, so I guess I'm confused because I'm telling everybody there are C1, C2, C3, C4, and this is telling me no, there are X, E, M, and all that stuff. So I am going to get to the bottom of this now. Okay, so now I am reading an article that says the classification of X-ray solar flares. So I was telling you guys something and I was wrong, so I'm sorry about that, because here I read an article that said C1 to C4, but here it says C1 to C9, and there's all these XM flares. So I am going to read this part now. It says the classification of X-ray solar flares, or solar flare alphabet soup. A solar flare is an explosion on the sun that happens when energy stored in twisted magnetic fields, usually above sunspots, is suddenly released. Flares produce a burst of radiation across the electromagnetic spectrum, from radio waves to X-rays and gamma rays. Scientists classify solar flares according to their X-ray brightness in the wavelength range 1 to 8 angstrom. So I think 1 angstrom is something like 10 to the minus 6 meters or 10 to the minus 8 centimeters, something like that. There are three categories. X-class flares are big. They are major events that can trigger planet-wide radio blackouts and long-lasting radiation storms. M-class flares are medium-sized. They can cause brief radio blackouts that affects Earth polar regions. Minor radiation storms sometimes follow an M-class flare. Compared to an X and M-class events, C-class flares are small with few noticeable consequences here on Earth. So earlier there was CMXA and all this, and now they didn't talk about C, but now they're talking about C. And I thought C-class flares were 1 to 4, but here it says 1 to 9. This figure shows a series of solar flares detected by NOAA satellites in July 2000. So they are, it shows peaks in a, there's a graph here. And it's universal time versus watts in per watts meters to the minus 2. Each category for X-ray flares has 9 subdivisions ranging from C1 to C9, M1 to M9, and X1 to X9. It's a logarithmic scale. M1 is 10 times stronger than C1. X1 is 10 times stronger than M1, and so on. So here it says the class B. It's less than 10 to the minus 6 watts per meter squared. C is between 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the minus 5 watts per meter squared. M is 10 to the minus 5, between 10 to the minus 5 and 10 to the minus 4. And X is greater than 10 to the minus 4. So it says this explanation of solar flares classification is brought to you by online cricket betting, where the outcome of the game is heavily dependent on the weather. Okay, That's really nice to know, isn't it? So I'm going to read this further because I thought it was C1 to C4, but oh, it's finished. Okay, so I was wrong. It says C1 to C4 earlier, but then this article says C1 to C9, and there's X class and M class. So there's C class flares, M class flares, which are more powerful, and X class flares, which are the most powerful, and the range in and it's measured in watts per meter squared between 1 and 8 angstroms. So I don't want to complicate it. I don't want to try to explain something and get tied up. Okay, so here's a good one. What is a C-class solar flare? Because that's what I was talking about. C-class solar flares are minor solar flares that have little to no effect on Earth. Only C-class solar flares, which are long in duration, might produce a coronal mass ejection, but they are usually slow, weak, and rarely cause a significant geomagnetic disturbance on Earth. So what is required here? There are so many classifications. Now here's another classification system. They are ranked according to their strength. So before I said they're C, M, and X, but here it says the smallest ones are A class, followed by B, then C, then M, then X, the largest. Solar flares are giant explosions on the sun that send energy, light, and high-speed particles into space. Okay, so this previous article said there's only C, M, and X, but this little thing on Google, I pressed it, it said, what are the levels of solar flares? So there's A, B, C, M, and X, where earlier I said C, M, and X, and they range from 1 to 9, and I thought it was 1 to 4, so so I am going to get away from this before I get myself into more trouble. So what I'm going to talk now, there's a solar storm that hit us on Earth, and let's see what this says, because so what I'm going to do for next week, I'm going to prepare. I like to be spontaneous on this show, because if I rehearse it, you can tell it's being rehearsed, and I like the surprise of finding out new things, so it's more genuine to me anyway. But then I just did that solar flare stuff. So what I'm going to do now is talk about surprise solar storm bashes Earth with a second wave predicted for Monday. So this article was on Sunday, so a couple days ago. The article is titled Surprise Solar Storm Bashes Earth with a Second Wave Predicted for Monday by Jennifer Nalowicki, and the subtitle said the moderate storm is a result of sunspot. So here it says, shows a big picture of a furious sun. A solar storm slammed into Earth over the weekend, so this is a couple days ago, and it's possible that another one could strike later on Monday, August 8th. I didn't notice it. Classified as moderate by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, Space Weather Prediction Center, the G2 geomagnetic storm, which pummeled our planet on Sunday, August 7th, was a result of a solar wind stream of charged particles from the sun striking Earth's magnetic field. A second storm, classified as G1 or minor storm, may hit sometime on Monday. According to spaceweather.com, the weekend storm, which was not forecast and came unexpectedly, reached speeds of up to 373 miles per second. Solar winds have been known to reach speeds of 500 miles per second, according to space.com. If another storm does hit, NOAA reported that high latitude power systems could be impacted, which could potentially lead to issues for power grids and GPS devices. Spacecraft in orbit also could be affected due to an increase in high energy electrons within the magnetosphere, as well as animal behavior, as some migratory animals rely on Earth's magnetic field to navigate. Nice report. The sun is spitting out solar storms left and right these days as it's reaching the peak of its roughly 11-year cycle. Because of this, it's more likely that sunspots, which NASA defines as areas of the sun that appear dark due to being cooler than elsewhere on the sun's surface, will likely pop up, resulting in additional solar events. These spots appear cooler and darker than their surroundings due to strong magnetic fields inhibiting the flux of hot new gas from the sun's interior. The ensuing solar storm sent social media ablaze, particularly in North America, where people were uploading aurora or northern lights, shadings of the sky bursting into brilliant shades of purple and red. I would have liked to have seen that. Tamitha Skov, a space physicist who goes by the pseudonym Space Weather Woman, tweeted on Sunday, and quote, "We've just jumped to G2 levels, mainly due to north-south-north flipping of the solar magnetic field." End quote. Every 11 years, the sun's magnetic poles will flip, causing the south pole to become the north pole and vice versa, according to the Australian Academy of Science. The NOAA ranks storms on a 5-level scale. See, here it says 5-level. I thought it was G1 to G4, and earlier there's a thing that says G1 to G9. But anyway, here it says the NOAA ranks solar storms on a 5-level scale, with G5 being the highest. The worst solar storm ever documented occurred in 1859 and is known as the Carrington event. During that historic storm, the aurora borealis was seen as far south as Hawaii, and telegraph equipment sparked so wildly that offices were set on fire, according to space.com. Okay, so this is interesting because I thought the solar storms were ranked 1 to 4, but here it says 1 to 9. So what I'm going to do now, I am going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about supermoons and cool stuff like that. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. I suppose what I did in the first part of the show is talk about solar storms, and I thought, for some reason, I was talking about four classifications of solar storm, but there's A, B, C, M, and X, and one article only talked about C, M, and X. I thought there was four classes of C storms, but then one article said, no, there's nine, and then the next article said NOAA classifies solar storms on a scale of 1 to 5. So 5 being the strongest. And there's a logarithmic scale in which to measure solar storms, just like there is earthquakes. So on a Richter scale on earthquakes, if you have a 5 earthquake or a 6 on the Richter scale, I think 6 is 10 times stronger than than 5. Same goes with solar storms. It says, for example, C and M. M's are 10 times stronger than C, and X is 10 times stronger than M, and X is also 100 times stronger than C. So I'll get away from that now, because I talked enough about it. Now let's talk about some other stuff we're going to be viewing on August 11th, which is when this show would air. So I'm not sure if it means August 10th going on into midnight, so August 11th in the morning. Or if this says August 11th, does that mean at night when August 11th and goes into August 12th? But anyway, if you want to really see a supermoon, go August 11th. So see it on, look up in the sky on August 10th and then August 11th. And you're bound to see it. So this article is called Last Supermoon of the Year. The Sturgeon Moon rises August 11th. Published 2 days ago. This will be the 4th supermoon in a row and the last one of 2022. As summer slips into autumn and nights begin to grow longer, the final supermoon of the year will make a big splash Thursday, August 11th. Nicknamed the Sturgeon Moon, August full moon peaks around 9:36 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Thursday. Although the moon will appear bright and full on Wednesday and Friday night, August 10th and August 12th as well. The Sturgeon Moon will be the 4th supermoon in a row, following the Buck Moon in July, the Strawberry Moon in June, and the Flower Moon, which also featured a total lunar eclipse, in May. August full moon will be the final supermoon of the year, according to the Farmer's Almanac. And anybody that's done this before, you look at when there's a partial moon in its phases, not the full moon, but you can see the terminator where all the craters are. It's beautiful to see. So if you have a chance to do that, try to do that as well. Maybe it'll take a couple of weeks, or maybe in 1 week you'll start to see some of the craters along the terminator. So why the fishy nickname? It's called Sturgeon. So why? The Maine Farmer's Almanac began printing Native American names for full moons in the 1930s, according to NASA, and these names have become commonplace today. The Sturgeon Moon's name comes to us from the Algonquin tribes of what is now eastern North America, as large sturgeon fish were more easily caught in the Great Lakes at this time of year. The full moon occurs about, that's interesting, okay. The full moon occurs about once a month when the sun, earth, and moon align on an invisible 180-degree line. The moon's orbit is about 5 degrees different from Earth's, so it is usually a little higher or lower than the Earth's shadow, enabling the sun's rays to illuminate the side facing Earth. See, the more you read, the more you learn. The next full moon peaks on Saturday, September 10th. The moon is typically called the harvest moon.
As summer slips into autumn and nights begin to grow longer, the final supermoon of the year will make a big splash Thursday. Nicknamed the Sturgeon Moon, August's full moon peaks around 9:36 Thursday night on the East Coast. Although the moon will appear bright and full on Wednesday and Friday night as well. A supermoon is a full moon that occurs while the moon is around or at its closest point to Earth. Supermoons can appear larger and up to 16% brighter in the sky than the average full moon. The Sturgeon Moon will be the 4th supermoon in a row, following the Buck Moon in July, the Strawberry Moon in June, and finally the Flower Moon in May, which also featured a total lunar eclipse. The Maine Farmer's Almanac began printing Native American names for full moons in the 1930s, and these names have become commonplace today. The Sturgeon Moon's name comes to us from the Algonquin tribes of what is now eastern North America, as large sturgeon fish were more easily caught in the Great Lakes at this time of year. The full moon occurs about once a month when the sun and moon align on an invisible 180-degree line. The moon's orbit is about 5 degrees different from Earth's, so it is usually a little higher or lower than Earth's shadow, enabling the sun's rays to illuminate the site facing Earth. The next full moon peaks on Saturday, the 10th of September. That moon is typically called the harvest moon.
Okay, thank you for listening to that. Basically, the person just repeated what I just said earlier. Most publications consider this a supermoon, meaning the full moon occurs while the moon is nearest its closest point to Earth, also known as perigee, during the current orbit. The Sturgeon Moon will appear within 90 degrees of perigee, making it a supermoon by most scientific definitions. Some publications put specific distance or time constraints on supermoons, meaning the Sturgeon Moon may not fit the bill for every publication. Supermoons can appear larger and up to 16% brighter in the sky than the average full moon, according to timeanddate.com. So believe it or not, I did not know that the moon is 5 degrees higher than Earth's plane, so that's why Earth's shadow doesn't cover it. Oh, that's so cool. All these little facts are fun. The Sturgeon Moon will be the fourth supermoon in a row.
A full moon shows up to Earthly viewers when the moon's orbit takes it around to the point where sun, Earth, and moon line up. And the onrushing sunlight fully splashes the Earth-facing face of the moon. But does that cause any special weirdness here on Earth? The full moon is more than just a passing phase. During the full moon, and also at the completely dark new moon phase, gravity of the nearby moon lines up in phase with gravity of the faraway but hugely massive sun to cause higher tides in Earth's oceans. Now, could all that crazy gravity slosh around the liquids inside our living bodies, and what could happen if they did? Well, people have long speculated, but turns out the idea that exposure to the full moon causes insanity is, well, just sheer lunacy. Study after study has found no statistical correlation between observed psychotic episodes, or crime statistics, or animal bites. Really, you're not any more likely to hideously mutate into your werewolf form on the night of the full moon than you are on any other night. Some species of real wolves do seem to like to howl at the full moon, but researchers are not quite sure yet just why. Buddhism teaches that all full moon days are holy. Judaism marks at least 3 significant yearly holidays by the full moon. And many cultures around the earth give a pet name to each passing full moon.
Buck moon, oak moon, milk moon, pink moon, hay moon, grain moon, old moon, cold moon, egg moon.
And once in a blue moon, we get 2 full moons in a month, which is really just a trick of the calendar we picked. With the moon, the earth, and even the sun constantly in motion, there's actually only one infinitely short instant when the moon is truly full. At that one moment, the far side of the moon actually is the dark side of the moon. And finally, here's a tip. The full moon is the very worst time to observe the moon. The harsh lighting is too bright and too flat to show you the true beauty of Earth's magnificent natural satellite. So that's the full moon. This is your 2-Minute Universe, and I'm Dave Brody.
Thank you for listening to that. So it makes you wonder, he said, the fact that the moon is full, that does not mean that that stirs up something in our bodies. And he actually used the word lunacy. So it really makes you wonder, huh? Does lunacy, luna, moon, that's I guess Italian, or the, what's it called? Latin name for the moon. Okay, we had a couple of crashes lately. A Chinese, I believe it was a satellite, splashed down, I think, in the Indian Ocean. And SpaceX space junk crash lands an Australian sheep farm. So researchers say there is a 10% risk that someone will die being hit by space debris in the next 10 years. Interesting stuff, but we're kind of lucky that the moon, the Earth, is about 70% or so of the surface of the Earth. Water is, that is. So the oceans, it's probably where it's going to land. Okay, I'm going to take a break now. When we're going to come back, we're going to talk about Steve. Yeah, I'm going to keep you in suspense. So we're going to reveal the mystery of Steve, S-T-E-V-E. What does that mean? When I come back, we'll talk about it. See, I'm going crazy because you know what? Tomorrow there's a full moon and I'm going to turn into Woolworth anytime. So before I do that, I'm going to take a break. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
Redcap Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
CITR 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine are celebrating Asian heritage by telling notable stories of Asian Canadians.
Ujjal Dosanjh was born in Jalandhar, India in 1947 and moved to Vancouver at the age of 17. He learned English by editing a Punjabi newspaper, eventually earning a law degree at UBC. After practicing family and personal injury law in private practice, he was elected as MLA to Vancouver Kensington in 1991. From there, he became Attorney General in 1997 and Canada's first South Asian Premier in February of 2000.
For more information about how to celebrate Asian heritage in Vancouver, visit exploration.org.
Hello, welcome back. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. I think you're all pretty lucky because I turned back into a human being during the break. It made me think about Michael J. Fox. He was on that movie Teen Wolf. I never saw it. But he probably turns into a wolf during a full moon. And that's what probably happens to all werewolves. Okay, so I left you in mystery. I was going to talk about Steve. So let's talk about Steve. See, there's a full moon and if you can hear it, there's sirens outside. So something is happening. Something eerie and weird is happening. Okay. So we're going to talk about Steve now. So what is Steve? I don't know, but it says in the story there's a Steve happening. So it's in capital letters, S-T-E-V. Steve depends on North America. Sorry. See? The sirens, the full moons making me act weird. Not Steve depends. Steve descends on North America after surprise solar storm. It is published 11 hours ago, and since today's Tuesday, it was published on Tuesday, August the 9th. It looks like an aurora, but remains a phenomenon completely unknown to science. So here is Steve. It is a fisheye lens photo of Steve, the mysterious purple river of light hanging in the sky over Canada. Okay, so let's find out what Steve is doing here. In the dark of Sunday night and Monday morning, August 7th and August 8th, a surprise solar storm slammed into Earth, showering our planet in a rapid stream of charged particles from the sun. The resulting clash of solar and terrestrial particles in Earth's atmosphere caused stunning auroras to appear at much lower altitudes than usual, and in southern Canada triggered a surprise cameo from the mysterious sky phenomena known as Steve. So that's S-T-E-V-E, capital S, capital T, capital E, capital V, capital E. Alan Dyer, an astronomy writer and photographer based in southern Alberta, Canada. I have one of his books, caught the wispy ribbons of green and violet light on camera as they shot through the sky. So says Alan Dyer, and quote, Steve lasted about 40 minutes, appearing as the aurora to the north subsided, Dyer wrote on Twitter. Steve was discovered here, so he likes appearing here more than anywhere else, end quote. So let's find out what Steve is. And here's a related article. Earliest documented aurora found in ancient Chinese text.
Okay.
As Dyer noted, the strange sky glow called Steve was first described by citizen scientists and aurora hunters in northern Canada in 2017. Steve is typically composed of an enormous ribbon of purplish light, which can hang in the sky for an hour or more, accompanied by a picket fence of green light that usually disappears within a few minutes. See, I told you this was weird. The full moon's creating weird stuff in the sky. The growing river of light may look like an aurora, but it's actually a unique phenomenon that was considered completely unknown to science upon its discovery. Today, scientists have a slightly better idea of what's going on. So, is this supernatural I'm talking about? Maybe. Once, when I was going to Las Vegas, I was sitting next to a guy from Seattle, and he told me he's a warlock. Okay, so I believed him. Steve, short for Strong Thermal Velocity Enhancement, is a long thin line of hot gas that slices through the skies for hundreds of miles. The hot air inside Steve can blaze at more than 5,500 degrees Fahrenheit or 3,000 degrees Celsius and move roughly 500 times faster than the air on each side of it, satellite observations have shown. Whereas the northern lights occur when charged solar particles bash into molecules in Earth's upper atmosphere, Steve appears much lower in the sky in a region called the sub-auroral zone. Okay, so now we know there's a sub-auroral zone. That likely means solar particles aren't directly responsible for Steve, Live Science previously reported. However, Steve almost always appears during solar storms like Sundays, showing up after the northern lights have already begun to fade. One hypothesis suggests that Steve is a result of a sudden burst of thermal and kinetic energy in the subauroral zone, somehow triggered by the clash of the charged particles higher in the atmosphere during aurora-inducing solar storms. However, more research is needed to uncover the true secrets of Steve. In the meantime, we can simply bask in its otherworldly glow and wave back at its twinkling green figures. Okay, so I guess Steve then is a line of purplish light that appears when aurora is going to end, and it was discovered 2017, about 5 years ago, and it was in northern Canada.
Okay. From that field line snapping that energy release. A coronal mass ejection is some of the sun's like plasma soup actually being like burped out of the sun.
I love that phrase, plasma soup.
It's just the bright flash that you'll see of radiation. The solar flares is just a bright flash that you'll see of radiation.
Okay.
From that field line snapping that energy release. A coronal mass ejection is some of the sun's like plasma soup actually being like burped out of the sun.
I love that phrase, plasma soup.
Tasty plasma soup.
Pretty, but I mean, a little terrifying, right? I mean,
yeah.
Does it affect Earth?
So it does, but not in like a, so not in a, in an always really terrible way. Most of the time, the Earth has a pretty strong magnetic field. Which is really, really good news for us because it protects us from all of these like highly energized particles that the sun has just spewed out at us. In this case, at like speeds of like 2 million miles per hour, which is just, I guess, 33 times less than the speed of light. Pretty quick. So what the Earth's magnetic field will do is it will absorb all of these particles. The energy will go into stretching out the magnetic field in space. So it's like it's kind of bunched out towards the it gives it a long tail. And then most of those particles will gather kind of towards the poles, where they will like go downwards and then energize some of the molecules in the atmosphere. And when these molecules in the atmosphere then give out light in order to kind of go down to a lower energy level, that's why we see the aurora. Now, because there's so many of these like particles coming in, you're getting auroras much lower down along the northern hemisphere than you would normally expect to see.
That's a nice effect there. And I know that people had already taken video from it. This is from Manitoba in Canada. Beautiful, just absolutely beautiful.
Yeah. And like, I think also you could see the aurora in the U.S. certainly, like as far south as Pennsylvania, Iowa, and Oregon over the last few days as well.
Oh, right. On spaceweather.com that you guys were sharing information from, they showed some pictures. Purple. I mean, purple. What an aura that Earth is giving off of this aurora. And, you know, when you mentioned poles, I'm like, that's why they're always up there towards the poles. We got to get closer to some poles then.
Well, thank you for listening. I am going to end my show now. And remember, there's a full moon the next couple days. You can watch it. And when you hear this broadcast, whoever's listening on Thursday, August 11th, probably the werewolves will be listening, you can see the full moon, Sturgeon Moon. And I'm signing off now because some weird stuff's happening to me. I'm starting to grow hair on my palms and my nails are... Okay, what I really recommend is, for example, if you go to this article, it's called Steve Depends on North... Or sorry, again, not Depends, Descends. Steve Descends on North America After Surprise Solar Storm. So you'll see this big purple light, and you also see an explanation of how the magnetosphere of Earth works. So not just listening to the people, but seeing the actual video itself, they show nice pictures. Okay, so I am going to do one more thing, because why not keep in line of talking about things that are happening in the sky around Earth. I'm going to talk about the Perseids meteor shower. So this article is called, it's on livescience.com. It's called How to Watch the Perseids Peak Despite the Full Moon. And it's by Brandon Spector, published about 20 hours ago. So since I'm talking to you around midnight on Tuesday, August, going into Wednesday, August the 10th, then this was published on August the 9th. And again, it's by Brandon Spector, a name I've heard a lot before, so he's a famous guy. And the article, again, is called How to Watch the Perseids Peak Despite the Full Moon. Stargazers can catch up to 20 meteors an hour this week, NASA says. So I could have mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again now. This recalls the time when I was in Hawaii on top of I went to the Big Island just to talk to astronomers, and it was Christmas, so nobody was there. It was the end of August, so I didn't get any interviews, but I did go up top to the peak, and it was quite cold. All the Japanese tourists were there with their parkas and their big orange parkas and their big fluffy orange pants, and they were cold as anything. And of course, I went up on my shorts with a t-shirt, and just to show off, I took off my shirt, and everybody wanted to pose with me. So anyway, why am I saying this? Because because there was a full moon at that time, so we couldn't see the Milky Way as well as we could have seen it without the full moon. So I could have planned my trip better. I don't know. I'm an astronomer, and I didn't plan my trip very well because I went up there when there was a full moon. Okay, anyway. Once a year, from mid-July to late August, Earth passes through a cosmic junk heap that pelts our planet with thousands of tiny space rocks no wider than a grain of sand. We call this annual event the Perseid meteor shower, or simply the Perseids. This year, the Perseids peak in the dark hours between August 11th and 12th. Unfortunately, the fact that there's a bright full moon around the same time will dampen the show. You may be able to see 10 to 20 meteors per hour during the peak, according to NASA, down from the 50 to 60 per hour visible on a non-full moon year. Still, you should be able to catch some shooting stars in the nights leading up to the peak as well. The Perseids are one of the most popular and consistent meteor showers of the year. They occur each summer when our planet passes through the vast tail of debris dropped by the comet Swift-Tuttle, which made its close approach to Earth in 1992. As Earth swoops through the comets, icy, rocky leftovers, small bits of debris plunge through our atmosphere, heating up to more than 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit or 1,650 degrees Celsius and streaking through the sky at more than 100,000 miles per hour or 160,000 kilometers per hour. Most of these tiny meteors burn to a crisp in the atmosphere, though a rare few crash land on the planet's surface, whereupon they earn the new title meteorites. So there's meteor, meteoroid, and meteorite. While the Perseids last several weeks, the greatest spectacle begins when Earth passes through the densest part of Comet Swift-Tuttle's debris cloud. On a typical year, stargazers can expect to see about 60 meteors per hour during the shower's peak, according to NASA. This year, that number will be consistently lower as the full Sturgeon Moon will obscure some of these falling rocks with its bright light. To give yourself the best shot at seeing the Perseids peak, Life Science's sister site, space.com, recommends heading out into the darkest place you can find in the pre-dawn hours of August 12th, one of the nights leading up to the peak. Settle in as your eyes can take up to 30 minutes to adjust to the darkness and look north towards the constellation Perseus, which follows behind the bright W-shaped constellation Cassiopeia. So this makes me recall times when I actually had a nice picture of the night sky in my mind, and that time has gone. I forgot what the constellations look like. Oh, I know what Cassiopeia looks like, but anyway. Meteor showers are typically named after the constellation from where the meteors appear to radiate. In this case, Perseus. In reality, the meteors are right there in the atmosphere. Humans have been watching the Perseids for thousands of years. In 1862, twin astronomers Lewis Swift and Horace Tuttle independently discovered a massive near-Earth comet, now known as the Comet Swift-Tuttle. A few years later, another astronomer realized that this comet produced the Perseid meteor shower, according to NASA. Comet Swift-Tuttle is massive. In fact, NASA says it's the largest object known to repeatedly fly past Earth. The comet's nucleus, the solid central part of the comet, separate from the bright glow that surrounds it, measures about 16 miles, 26 kilometers wide. For comparison, the Chicxulub asteroid that hit Earth 65 million years ago and led to the extinction of the dinosaurs only measured about 7.5 miles. So this is more than twice as wide. So it's something like, I would guess, something from, if you measured from UBC to SFU, and that's about 140 blocks, which is something like 11 miles, so it's probably bigger than that. So it's from UBC past SFU into Coquitlam. So that's a big, big sucker, isn't it? Very big. Swift-Tuttle orbits the Sun, completing a full pass every 133 years. That's what I was looking for. Astronomers have calculated the massive space rock's trajectory thousands of years into the future and have found that the comet does not pose any threat of colliding with Earth on its current path. Nice. Swift-Tuttle will make an unexpectedly close flyby in the year 3044, according to space.com, when it will pass within a million miles of our planet. That's painfully close in astronomical terms, but it's still twice the average distance between Earth and the Moon, meaning there is little risk for whatever life inhabits the Earth 1,000 years from now. Okay, that's nice to know. Now here's an interesting article. Of course, I'm going to say it's interesting, but it says astronomers plan to fission an interstellar meteorite out of the ocean using a massive magnet. This is the meteorite that fell to Earth in 2014. It was published today, August the 9th, by Jamie Carter. So again, the article is called Astronomers Plan to Fish an Interstellar Meteorite Out of the Ocean Using a Massive Magnet. Astronomers are planning to a fishing trip to land an extraterrestrial interloper on Earth, a small meteorite from another star system that crashed into the Pacific Ocean with energy equivalent to about 121 tons or 110 metric tons of TNT. The team from Harvard University hopes to find fragments of the interstellar rock known as CNEOS 2014-01-08, which slammed into Earth on January 8, 2014. So says Amir Siraj, an astrophysicist at Harvard University. And quote, finding such a fragment would represent the first contact humanity has ever had with material larger than dust from beyond the solar system, end quote. Siraj identified the object's interstellar origin in a 2019 study with 99.999% confidence, but it wasn't until May 2022 that it was confirmed to Siraj by the U.S. Space Command. There are no known witnesses to the object striking Earth, so I wonder how they know it is interstellar. So says Siraj, and quote, it struck the atmosphere about 100 miles or 160 kilometers off the coast of Papua New Guinea in the middle of the night with about 1% the energy of the Hiroshima bomb, end quote. Measuring just 1.5 feet or 0.5 meters wide, CNEOS 2014-01-08 now appears to have been the first interstellar object ever discovered in our solar system. Previously, an oblong object called Oumuamua held that title, discovered in 2017 during the Pan-STARRS Sky Survey, I remember that. The spacey rock zipped through our solar system at nearly 57,000 miles per hour, or 92,000 kilometers per hour, and later, Harvard astrophysicist A.V. Loeb, a colleague of Siraj, claimed it might be an alien machine. Oumuamua's discovery was followed in 2019 by Comet 21/Borisov, the first interstellar comet, which was spotted by an amateur astronomer, Gennady Borisov, in Crimea. So again, how do they know it's interstellar? CNEOS 2014-01-08 is thought to be from another star system because it was traveling at 37.2 miles per second, 60 kilometers per second, relative to the Sun. That's too fast for it to be bound by the Earth, by the Sun's gravity. Okay, now I had my question answered. So says Siraj, and quote, as the Earth's distance from the, at the Earth's distance from the Sun, any object traveling faster than about 42 kilometers per second or 26 miles per second is on an unbounded hyperbolic escape trajectory relative to the Sun. This means that CNEOS 2014-01-08 was clearly exceeding the local speed limit for bound objects, and it doesn't cross paths with any other planets along the way, so it must have originated from outside our solar system, of our solar system, end quote. Cut to Siraj and Loeb's Galileo project, a $1.6 million expedition to lower a magnet similar in dimensions to a king-size bed at 1.3 degrees south, 147.6 degrees east, the U.S. Department of Defense location of the meteorite's resting spot. That's about 186 miles, or 300 kilometers, north of Manus Island in the Bismarck Sea in the southwest Pacific Ocean. So here it shows a nice little map, and that's where it hit. CNEOS 2014-01-08 greatly exceeded the material strength of a typical iron meteorite, which should make it even easier to recover, according to CIRAG. Material strength refers to how easily something can resist being deformed or damaged by a load. Most meteorites contain enough iron that they will stick to the type of magnet we plan on using for the ocean expedition. Given its extremely high material strength, it is very likely that the fragments of CNEOS 2014-01-08 are ferromagnetic. So cool. Leaving from Papua New Guinea, the Galileo's project ship would use a magnetic sled on a long line winch, which will be towed along the seabed at 1 mile or 1.7 kilometers for 10 days. It's hoped the magnet can recover tiny fragments of the meteorite, measuring as small as 0.004 inches or 0.1 millimeters across. However, it's unclear when the astronomers will be able to mount their expedition. The Galileo project already has $500,000 committed, with a further $1.1 million required to make it a reality. That's good value, according to a space mission, according to CIRAG. So says CIRAG and COPE, the alternative way to study an interstellar object at close range is by launching a space mission to a future object passing through the Earth's neighborhood. But that would be 1,000 times more expensive, at about $1 billion. And this says, end quote, said CIRAG, who with Loeb is also working out the details of such a mission should another object like Oumuamua appear in the solar system. Okay, that's the end of this article. Kind of interesting stuff. But I said I was going to talk about the solar system, and here's a map of Papua New Guinea, and it shows it was north of the island, Papua Neve, and they said about 160 kilometers away. So thank you for listening. We talked about a lot of night sky stuff and solar system stuff, but we also talked about these interstellar meteorites. And it's cool to learn that this was not bound by the sun's gravity, and it's traveling too fast to be a solar system meteorite or comet, so they say it's interstellar. I love how science works. Thank you for listening. This has been Marco. You have listened to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.